The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Today's jobs report showing that U.S. hiring downshifted abruptly in August with the smallest jobs gain in 7 months. As Charlie mentioned, it complicates a potential decision by the Federal Reserve to begin scaling back monetary policy support by year end. The number we got today, non-farm payrolls increasing 235,000 last month. Economists surveyed by Bloomberg, they wanted to see something more in line with 735,000. So a big miss there. Let's get into it with Becky Frankiewicz, president of Manpower Group North America. She joins us as she does many jobs days on the phone from Chicago. Becky, really great to have you back on the show. Is there any silver lining to this jobs report today?
Yeah, Tim. So definitely not a report anyone wanted to see. I would tell you that I'd characterize August as a report of dashed hopes on both sides of the labor, you know, environment. Employers were hoping for the September sunrise that we had spoke about before with increased labor supply and recovery of supply chains, you know, and Delta dashed that. And workers were hoping for this smooth transition, you know, sending kids off to school, returning to work without fear of COVID. That's been dashed too. But I will tell you that we believe the situation is temporary, and I have real-time data that tells us why.
Well, let's hear about that real-time data. What does the future look like?
Yeah, so hi, Katie. We still know we're in a workers' market, and here's why. There are 10.1 million open jobs, so jobs unfilled in our country today. Demand remains right now above pre-pandemic levels, and unemployment continues to decline. So that is a silver lining, Tim, to your question. And we also know, and this is some new data, we know that the talent shortage is especially acute in blue-collar roles. So let's just step back and say, you know, in the past year, demand for knowledge workers, so think medical, you know, IT space, that demand has increased 14%. You're thinking that's a pretty good number. Yet demand for blue-collar jobs has increased 24% with a 50% rise in operations logistics alone as the shift to online is here to stay. So, you know, we anticipate hiring spikes in ops, logistics, retail as we prepare for the holiday period. So that is the silver lining. But this jobs report in August, you know, ahead of the stimulus stoppage as we go into September, you know, was a disappointing one. There's no way around it.
There is, though, still this mismatch between supply and demand. If there are 10.1 million open jobs and still millions of people who are on the sidelines looking for work right now, why aren't they hopping off the sidelines?
Yeah, so it's unfortunately complicated. So, you know, part of it definitely is stimulus, but that can't answer everything. There is fear, you know, rising fear now around, you know, health, safety in the workplace. And there's complications as, you know, some schools are opening, schools are constantly threatening, are we going to go hybrid or not go hybrid? So it's really an uncertain time personally and professionally for workers in our country. And they are still sitting on the sidelines. And again, what's so disappointing is we all hoped and wanted and believed that we would be past this as we went back into the back-to-school season, but we're not quite out of the woods yet.
Yeah, it's definitely not the start to September that I think many companies and just people expected. But yeah. Becky, I want to pick up on your point on stimulus, because we do have those enhanced unemployment benefits starting to roll off next week. And like you said, there's still 10.1 million jobs unfilled. I'm curious what you think that the end of those sorts of programs could mean for the labor market and jobs reports going forward.
Yeah, so we've been tracking it state by state, Katie, as the stimulus has ended. And what we've found is it's very uneven. So in some states, you know, especially in states in the South, where when stimulus came in, it didn't have as big of a dampening effect. We didn't see as big of a recovery effect when the stimulus came off. In other states, we're just starting to see it roll off now. We have seen some positive momentum come out of a couple of the states as the stimulus stops. But I can tell you one thing, no matter what the state does, this is not, stopping stimulus is not going to have the, you know, solve effect that we all wanted it to have. We're going to have to make sure that workers feel safe, they feel valued, they can trust their employers to send people home that are sick, that are around them, and that really is becoming, you know, this trust and care economy is truly the way forward for the American worker.
Becky, Manpower Group is the world's third largest staffing firm, so you do have a really good understanding of what is happening in different areas of the world when it comes to people going back to work or what they want at a firm. What are you seeing in terms of the return to the office, especially among large Wall Street banks and financial services firms?
Yeah, so it's quite interesting. We just did a big 14,000 people survey in 14 countries, to your question, Tim. And what we found is really generationally, demographically, we're seeing some differences. So if you say, who's most excited to come back in the office? Gen Z. They're fresh out of college. They're looking to make their friends. It's where they find their dating pool. Like, they're learning. They're excited to be back in the office. Who's least excited? And this is global data. Millennials. You know, millennials are of childbearing, you know, child-raising years. They're very concerned about their children getting the virus now, which, you know, a year ago we were saying kids aren't really susceptible. That's okay. So now we know that that was inaccurate, and so there's concern there. Also excited to come back in the workplace are Gen X and our boomers. And think about who's running the world's companies right now. It is the Gen X and boomers. And so we see really varied interest about coming back into the workplace. Now, from a vaccination perspective, you know, that is giving some employees some confidence, particularly as headquarters start rolling out vaccinations. But still, you know, it's very uneven in terms of the excitement of coming back in the office every day of the week.
Becky Frankowitz, president at Manpower Group North America, joining us on the phone from Chicago on this Jobs Friday. Becky, thank you so much for taking the time. We really appreciate it.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
While Senate Democrats are discussing a wider range of tax proposals than President Joe Biden has proposed, this could include levies on stock buybacks, carbon emissions, and even executive compensation. This as part of a package of measures to help fund a ramping up in social spending. So writes Stephen T. Dennis. He is Senate reporter for Bloomberg News, and he joins us now on the phone from Washington, D.C. Stephen, it's really great to have you on the show this afternoon. Who are the Senate Democrats who are doing this? Because we know that not all Democrats feel the same when it comes to taxation.
Yeah, so basically the first thing they need to do is to get the Senate Finance Committee Democrats on board, and this is what's circulating among those Senate Finance Committee Democrats. They have yet to settle on a particular plan amongst themselves, but we do basically have the menu. You know, you're either lunch or you're on the menu or something or other. You know, that's the old saying. This is the menu of who's gonna make it to the lunch and who's gonna get eaten, and so you have all kinds of things that would potentially affect a lot of stocks, a lot of markets. You know, if you start saying, well, stock buybacks should be taxed just like dividends, or have an excise tax on stock buybacks, that would be a huge deal. Supersized CEO pay. You know, they're talking about having an excise tax on CEO pay that exceeds the average worker at that company by a margin they consider to be too high, and even things like mark-to-market rules for billionaires with large unrealized cap gains, which would be a big tax on a lot of entrepreneurs like Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos, who have very large amounts of unrealized capital gains.
And so, yeah, the implications widespread. I mean, just this year, we've already seen about $368 billion worth of buybacks. So, Stephen, I'm curious, does this have a shot of passing? I mean, like you said, you have to get the Senate Finance Committee Democrats on board. How likely is that to happen?
I think basically any one of these proposals is going to have a hard road. You know, right now Joe Manchin wants to press the pause button on the whole thing, and he wants a much smaller package. He's also, however, taken aim at some of the more traditional tax increases that Joe Biden's proposed. Like, you know, he doesn't want to go to 28% on the corporate tax rate, but he's talked about 25% on the corporate tax rate. Well, if you lose several hundred billion dollars there, you might be able to make it up somewhere else. And the question is whether Joe Manchin would stand in the way of some of these things. Now, certainly, I think you're going to have a hard time getting 50 Senate votes for some kind of a carbon tax, even if it turns into rebates for lower income folks, taxing plastic. You know, I could see some Democrats supporting that. That might be a harder sell, even with the White House. But there are these things that seem to be relatively low-hanging fruit, like these supersized IRAs. There are some people with tens of millions of dollars right. they've accumulated in their IRAs, and you could just say, well, we're going to cap those at $5 million, and anything over that, you have to have a distribution and pay taxes on it. So some of these things, I think, could very well end up in the package and are a little bit more likely to happen than others.
We should note that even today, when the president was speaking after that dismal jobs report came out, he did once again repeat the line that he will not raise taxes on people who make less than $400,000 a year. It's something that he continues to talk about. What do the Democrats who are proposing these want this money to pay for?
Yeah, so there's, you know, this $3.5 trillion package of social spending, everything from child care benefits to free community college to expanding Medicare benefits for dental and vision and hearing. There's just an enormous array of things that have been building up, frankly, for decades that Democrats have wanted, as well as things like paid sick leave and paid family leave and maternity leave and all these things. Well, that bill comes out to about $3.5 trillion over 10 years, which is about a 5% increase in federal spending, and you're going to have to find money to pay for it. And it gets, if your universe of who has to pay for it is people making more than $400,000 a year, that's not a lot of people, but that is a lot of money. And, you know, I think right. it's going to be very challenging to get it through because those people with the right. biggest pockets on earth can afford a lot of good lobbyists.
And guess what? A lot of those people are voting members of Congress. Stephen Dennis, Senate reporter at Bloomberg News, joining us on the phone from Washington, D.C. Stephen, thank you so much for taking the time. We really appreciate it. Check out his story on the Bloomberg Terminal. Senate Democrats eye taxes on stock buybacks and excess CEO pay.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio. This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, in the current issue of Bloomberg Business Week, it's the New Cities issue. It's Bloomberg Business Week magazine. And it's available on newsstands and at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. It's an issue that is focused on cities, and one city that it does take a very close look at. And an area of the city is Seattle, and a Seattle commercial district that has undergone trial by virus. The pandemic changed the heartbeat of urban areas across the U.S., few more so than the Pike Pine corridor of Seattle's Capitol Hill neighborhood. So writes Noah Buhire, finance reporter for Bloomberg News, and he joins us now on the phone from Seattle. Noah, for people who haven't been to Seattle or visited this particular area of Seattle, the Pike Pine corridor of Capitol Hill, what's it like?
Well, it's I think what a lot of people would imagine as a vibrant at all hours retail arts commercial district. There's music venues, a ton of restaurants. It's not giant buildings, but you've got a lot of, you know, 4 to 6, 7, 8 story apartment blocks that have retail at the ground floor. So it was really the part of Seattle that felt most city-like outside of downtown.
And what happened over the last year as the pandemic took hold and commuters started staying home and not going to those restaurants? And then just a few months later, in the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd, activists took to the streets there to demand racial justice.
Yeah, so look, it was an interesting neighborhood to follow for all those reasons you just mentioned. You know, a lot of the businesses in this corridor were the kinds of places that, you know, relied on a vibrant street life and people being able to get together. And obviously the pandemic made that difficult. And The other thing that was interesting about this neighborhood is that there are just a ton of smaller businesses. So, Amazon has one of their grocery stores there. There's a Starbucks Reserve Roastery in the neighborhood. So there's some corporate presence. But there were also a lot of small, scrappy businesses that just had to figure it out. With this piece, I followed a number of them through the last year and a half to figure out how they did it. Because while, a number of businesses did go under during the pandemic, a lot managed to get to this point through the generosity of customers, through government assistance programs, and just a lot of scrappiness that I don't think people have fully appreciated.
And so, Noah, it's a great piece. And one of the reasons why it's such a good read is because you did track a group of four businesses over the past year and a half. And I'm curious, you mentioned the scrappiness of the businesses and the business owners, but I'm curious if there was a uniting common denominator in how they were all able to get through the pandemic.
Yeah, that's a great question. I really think it is the constellation of factors. These were established businesses with loyal customers, and to the extent some of them were able to do GoFundMes, government assistance was just absolutely key. Programs like the Paycheck Protection Program, pretty much everyone took that money. It was either a form of bridge financing or to get them to other federal grants, or it was the thing itself that helped get them through. I think another underappreciated part of this is that we're talking about a city where a lot of people have been willing to get vaccinated, and even though we've had pretty strong public health restrictions here in Washington State throughout the pandemic, people were willing to go back to this neighborhood when those things lifted, because we're talking about a city where, more than 75% of people 12 and up have gotten their jabs.
Well, it's interesting because one of the elements of this that really sticks out to me, that really caught my attention, is the graphical representation of the change in weekly visits from 2019 that are in here. Charts that just show how foot traffic has not returned to retail establishments there, to restaurants there, even after the vaccine rollout, to music venues, for example. In some cases, restaurant visits are still down, even after vaccinations, 50% from 2019. How are these business owners dealing with that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I do want to highlight that the data here is really interesting. We were able to get foot traffic data on about 350 locations around this neighborhood. Most of them were, commercial establishments. And I think that data really does show you, like you said, that things are far from being back to normal.
Yeah.
And the reason these businesses are still, any of these owners will tell you things are not back to normal. I mean, they are still very much in the thick of this. And we're, going into the fall when things like outdoor dining are going to be harder to do, and frankly, in Seattle, just not comfortable because it rains so much here. So, I think that's a big part of this story, is that these businesses have been resilient, but they are by no means, out of the woods yet.
And so, Noah, one of the stats that caught my eyes in this story is that the median income in the city is over $100,000, which, as you note, is more than 50% higher than the national average. I'm curious, how important was that factor in explaining the resiliency of some of these businesses?
I don't think it can be understated. Look, there are academics who, have started studying the pandemic's effect on small business, and while the lens of this story is one particular neighborhood, what I can say is anecdotally, having customers and people who liked your businesses and supported them and who were willing to come in and spend more money and who, maybe kept their jobs throughout the pandemic, mm-hmm. has just been crucial. you know, two of these businesses had fundraisers, and they raised, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, and that was just completely instrumental to them, you know, being able to survive to this point.
Yeah, not something that would necessarily be possible in other parts of the country where the clientele who frequent these places don't have the same household incomes and wouldn't necessarily be able to afford, at least during a pandemic and during a time of uncertainty, to throw money and support, throw money at these businesses and support them, even in difficult times. Noah Buchheyer is finance reporter for Bloomberg News. Noah, thank you so much for joining us. The story is a Seattle commercial district's trial by virus. Bloomberg tracked a group of businesses in the Capitol Hill neighborhood for a year and a half and were amazed by their resilience. Check it out. It's featured in the New Cities issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. It's available on newsstands and at Bloomberg.com/businessweek.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
We cannot, Katie Greifeld, talk enough about crypto. Bitcoin, I almost said shares of Bitcoin. Bitcoin price higher by $834 right now. That's trading at $50,000, $383. Right now. David Konitsky is chief executive officer at Kraken Bank. Kraken Bank is one of the largest crypto exchanges with over 8 million users worldwide. They've had approximately 1.5 million new signups over the course of the second quarter of 2021. That is why I'm saying we cannot talk enough about crypto. David, thanks so much for joining us. You are joining us live from Cheyenne, Wyoming, where you are based. Katie and I were both talking during the break and we said, Wyoming. Why Wyoming? Tell us why.
Yeah, well, Wyoming passed the first of its kind new regulatory license here for a special purpose depository institution. It's a state chartered bank. And up until now, crypto companies have really been round peg square holed into existing licenses and regimes that didn't make a ton of sense. And we're kind of locked out of the existing banking world. So for that reason, we're bringing the U.S. business under a more certain, more formal and better regulatory regime, as well as expanding into new opportunities, new products and markets. As you see, everything's converging between crypto, neobanks, fintech, traditional. And so we want to be at the heart of that market
but,
as well.
But you do call yourself a bank.
Yeah, we are a state chartered bank.
And so Wyoming is interesting, obviously has positioned itself to be a crypto hotbed. Where does that stand with the rest of the United States? Are other states moving towards Wyoming, or is Wyoming really an outlier at this point?
Wyoming definitely got the ball started, but a number of states have, let's say, borrowed liberally from the Wyoming playbook and enacted their own version of a similar charter. And it's provoking federal regulators to take action as well. That's kind of the beauty of our republic and our system here, where states can be the laboratories of innovation and push things forward faster than the federal government has. So it's really been a spark that's moved the whole industry forward.
David, you say that Kraken will be the first United States crypto bank. It's I'm wondering the problem that you're setting out to solve here. What is not being met by traditional finance?
Yeah, so in the traditional regimes right now, you can either apply for 50 state money transmission licenses, or you can try, and none of them have like crypto specific language. They're built for like Western unions and fintechs of the world. And then, or you could try to pursue a banking license, but the federal regulators, the OCC, the FDIC, have been inconsistent about that. And they don't have written rules about how they're going to treat crypto that has a dedicated supervisory and oversight manual. We just want to know, hey, this is how we're going to be regulated and what our expectations are, and we can meet them. So for those reasons, the lack of clarity around some of the stuff in other states is really suboptimal. And banking has been a traditional problem for crypto. Kraken's lucky to have a swath of good third-party banking partners, but there's nothing like vertically integrating and controlling your own destiny direct to the Fed.
And so, David, I've always been curious, you know, how do you scale? Obviously, there are regulatory hurdles, but in terms of the average American who maybe only has a passing understanding of what Bitcoin and what cryptocurrencies are, how do you convince them that this is the next, wave of banking? This is the next evolution of how you handle money. How do you bring that message beyond just the cryptocurrency community?
Yeah, well, one, the cryptocurrency community is growing rapidly, and more kind of mainstream adoption is taking place. We think that's going to continue. So on the one hand, the market's coming to us. But on the other hand, yeah, this banking license lets us offer online mobile checking accounts and savings accounts and traditional equities brokerage, things like that, that, you know, mainstream America are used to. And so if you put that side by side for crypto, it's a kind of a great conversion mechanism.
You do know on Kraken Bank's website that you are not FDIC insured. The money that you put in, the crypto you put in, is not FDIC insured. Explain why that is a little bit, and why you think that consumers who might be a little concerned about that should or should not be.
Yeah, if anything, there are advantages to our structure. So the way that the FPDI charter works is we are required to be a fully reserved, fully backed bank. So we maintain, we take customer deposits and we keep 100% of it in cash. So we don't have the types of market or credit risks or insolvency risks that the FDIC was meant to protect against. So as a result, we're kind of exempt from having to apply for that. There is no, you know, risk because we're not lending money out into mortgage portfolios. We're not putting it into, we're not even putting it into treasuries, let alone longer duration or riskier instruments.
And so quickly, David, I'm curious, you know, Kraken was the first crypto exchange to receive a banking charter, and Kraken, along with crypto bank Avanti, have tried to tap into the Federal Reserve's payment system. Little luck so far. And I'm curious, wouldn't using the Fed's payment system sort of go against the spirit of crypto?
And David, we just have about 30 seconds, but then we're going to come back with you after we do some news.
Yeah. Well, one, our mission is to kind of promote the adoption of cryptocurrency to enable more financial freedom. One way to do that is to get a bridge from the legacy or traditional system to crypto. And then once they're in crypto, they can take all advantage of the crypto-centric kind of ethos.
Let's get back to David Konitsky, CEO at Kraken Bank, joining us once again on the phone from Cheyenne, Wyoming. David, Kraken Bank, and I should say Kraken was the first crypto exchange ever to receive a banking charter. I'm wondering, given the increased interest in crypto, the way we do see traditional financial institutions starting to embrace it, if you expect to get significant competition from the big names in banking and even community banks.
Yeah, I mean, I expect more and more to realize the opportunity and come to the market. We welcome them. Not particularly concerned about it, as you see, any new like technology medium. Normally, it's the folks who are kind of that native to that medium are the ones that do best. I think it'll be pretty challenging for institutions and incumbents to really adopt to crypto fully. But I think it does help the market more broadly. And I do think the question is the existing financial industry coming to crypto rather than crypto coming to the financial industry.
And so I want to switch gears and talk about stablecoins because I'm kind of obsessed with them. For those listening who don't know, stablecoins are cryptocurrencies that try to maintain a fixed exchange rate with a fiat currency. Usually it's the dollar. They try to maintain a one-to-one peg. They've come under a lot of scrutiny lately. Some people might have heard of Tether. It's the largest stablecoin. It was supposed to be backed one-for-one by U.S. dollars. We learned in May that it wasn't, that actually holds a ton of commercial paper, maybe $31 billion if you look at Tether's market cap. I'm curious what that could look like going forward. We know that Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen is concerned about stablecoins. Some Fed policymakers have made worried noises as well. I'm curious, David, whether you think that we could see regulation in that space.
Yeah, I always expect regulation in new financial markets, no doubt. I think the stable coins are a net benefit and a boon. In fact, the U.S. should love stable coins. It is the best way to maintain our dollar reserve and hegemony and for our kind of global reach and global economic clout.
And so the U.S. should love stablecoins, but we know that the U.S. doesn't love stablecoins. And you do have banks like Barclays warning that this could raise some really thorny issues for the Fed. If there is a run on Tether, people trying to redeem their holdings, that could cause Tether to dump commercial paper en masse. And the commercial paper market is crucially important to just the functioning of companies. So I'm curious, what would get the U.S. on board if they should love stablecoins?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that, it's not surprising that a bank would be wary of something that definitely is competitive to it. And there are certain areas of stablecoins that, you know, could potentially use a little bit more transparency, no doubt. And in fact, even Tether, which is certainly the more questionable ones in the market, like, it's getting better. And it is definitely changing its kind of like balance sheet to these concerns. So I do think that's going to change over time, and there's going to be more transparency, whether by force or just by market dynamics. So I expect that to happen sooner rather than later.
Hey, David, we only have a minute left. Give us an idea of the type of regulation you'd like to see on a federal level so we can see these types of charters become more widespread.
Yeah. So again, like I, as I said before, I think kind of the framing has been backwards a bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, the main question is not how to fit crypto into the existing frameworks in financial world today. It's how to update our financial industry for the economy of the future and stay innovative. And so what I'd like to see is clarity, right? So, and lack, like, less discretion, more clarity, defined treatment of crypto assets and expectations in terms of compliance and requirements, and dedicated supervisory and oversight programs that understand how crypto works.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. David Konitsky, CEO of Kraken Bank, joining us on the phone from Cheyenne, Wyoming. David, thank you so much for taking the time. A fascinating conversation, Katie. I know we got to get him on our other show, Quick Take Stock.
It Absolutely.
Airs each and every day at noon Eastern time at Bloomberg.com/QuickTake.
Yeah, and I mean, stablecoins, they're in almost every cryptocurrency transaction.
You are obsessed with stablecoins.
I am obsessed with it. It's the perfect intersection of fixed income with cryptocurrencies. You can't ask for anything better.
Well, if you're Katie Greifeld, you can't ask for anything better.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal. Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
He's gonna drive you home.
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
Just drive me crazy. It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
It is the Drive to the Close. We are just over 10 minutes away from the close of trading on this Jobs Friday, September 3rd, 2021. Brian Jacobson is joining us now, Senior Investment Strategist at Wells Fargo Asset Management, $604 billion of assets under management. Brian joins us on the phone from Milwaukee. We heard an update from Charlie Pellett just moments ago about what exactly is happening in the markets right now. Stocks struggling to find a direction. The S&P 500 is just down, not even a full point. So pretty much flat right now. Well, the NASDAQ is in the green and the Dow is lower by 0.1%. Brian, talk to us a little bit about the equity market reaction to today's jobs numbers. U.S. hiring slows sharply amid the Delta variant. Non-farm payrolls increasing only 235,000 last month, a huge miss. Why not a bigger equity market reaction?
Well, you know, that's a good question. When I saw the headline, my eyebrows went up.
Yeah, I said,
a little bit of shock.
Wow.
But, you know, and I think it's just because the equity market investors in general are looking at the details here, right? That leisure and hospitality was very weak. Retail was very weak. And so I think people can attribute it mainly to the rise of the Delta variant, just affecting consumer behavior, maybe potential employee behavior, that they're not as willing to go in those, you know, kind of high contact jobs. So there was strength in the manufacturing sector. And so I think that's really the explanation. Is it's still a good number. It's not great, right? Going from great to good doesn't have to be bad when we can attribute.
But it was such a big miss. I mean, 733,000 is the survey of economists that from Bloomberg. That's what we were looking for.
Well, that's true. Yeah, it is an awfully big miss, but it is, I think, to use the term that the Fed has really enjoyed using, it looks transitory. To the extent that the Delta variant looks like it might be peaking, I think that we could see a nice surge in September or October for job creation.
Well, let's wrap that into what we're expecting out of the Fed. If September is a really strong month for the labor market, I don't know, in conversations today, it feels like a Fed September tapering announcement is off the table. I'm curious how you think Federal Reserve policymakers and Jerome Powell are looking at today's number, knowing that we have, for example, enhanced unemployment benefits rolling off just next week.
Yeah, that is one of the factors that could lead to a September surge in hiring. If it's the rolling over of Delta, the expiration of those enhanced benefits. Our position is that we think that the Fed wasn't going to announce tapering per se in September, that they would actually likely like to tee up tapering in September. And so ever since the Jackson Hole speech, that's been our position, is that they would like to see that further progress on the labor front, and that likely in September they'll still say that if we continue to see decent gains and high inflation, that it would be appropriate in the next few meetings, which for us then that would mean likely in December, to actually start tapering.
Is so we this didn't think considered that a tapering decent in September was gain, on the table. Though? Would this be considered a decent gain?
Oh, I think so. I think that they would likely look through this and look at the details, saying that, you know, it's still a decent number on a 3-month moving average. We're not going to get another employment situation report by the September one, so they'll look at some of the other data. But I don't think they want to poo-poo this jobs report too much.
So I'd like to talk a little bit more about tapering, regardless of when we get the announcement, when tapering actually starts, when the Fed does start to reduce the pace of its monthly bond buying. How do you expect that to play out in markets, and particularly the bond market? Because theoretically, there will be less demand for bonds. I would think just by the laws of supply and demand, that should make yields go higher. But you haven't really seen that happen in the wake of Powell's Jackson Hole appearance.
Well, no, you know, and the Fed is a quite price-insensitive buyer of bonds, you know, $80 billion a month for treasuries and $40 billion a month for mortgage-backed securities. We also know that we have the debt ceiling, and so maybe issuance isn't quite what it will be come October, assuming that Congress passes a new budget and perhaps lifts the debt ceiling. And so we could have those technical factors at play where simple supply and demand would suggest that we should likely see yields rise. And that's been our position. We are expecting to see that, especially on the long end of the yield curve, because we know that the Fed has wanted to be somewhat neutral along the curve as far as what they're buying. And so we think that we could see the 10-year Treasury move up. We're actually more positioned for the longer end, say the 30-year, to move back above 2%. We're kind of down around 1.95-ish%. We think we could get back up to 2.25, maybe 2.15 to 2.25 by the end of the year. So a pretty decent move from here.
Hey, how are you thinking about inflation? Because we did see in this report, I guess you could say the silver lining was wage growth, and I'm wondering what that signal that sends you about potential price increases, in other words, inflation not necessarily being transitory, because wages aren't necessarily something that go down.
Yeah, that is one of the factors I think that could play into the Fed's thinking on this, that maybe they don't want to kind of remove or push out the timeline for tapering, is that you do see the wage growth. Some economists fear a wage price spiral. I personally don't think that that's necessarily always in the data. We haven't really seen real wage gains, especially for lower income workers, for this recovery or over the last few months. So if you look at the inflation numbers, those have increased faster than what we have seen the wages, especially on the lower end of the spectrum. So, you know, in a way, I think that the Fed would kind of welcomes to see that wage gain, but you don't want to see it jump too much to instill fear in investors that you are going to see some sort of wage price spiral.
And so, Brian, I'm going to bring up a kind of taboo topic because, like you say, inflation is high. We know there's wage pressure. If you look at the labor market, still millions of jobs short, and the rate of economic growth is slowing. So when can we talk about stagflation?
Well, I don't think we can really get to stagflation until we see negative growth. And it's mainly because the stagflation of the 1970s, right? You had double-digit inflation growth, and right now we're running anywhere from 3 to 5%. So until we get above, say, 7% with inflation, and if we see economic growth ratcheting down to something closer to maybe 1% real, I don't think that stagflation is appropriate. It's more about reflation. So you have the higher inflation, but you still have a recovery pace of economic growth. And that's why I think that the equity markets can still remain fairly attractive. You have low yields. Mm-hmm. Yes, you have high inflation. Hopefully it's transitory. But there is still decent growth. Going from great growth to good growth doesn't have to be bad.
Brian Jacobson, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for taking the time and joining us on Bloomberg Business Week. Brian, Senior Investment Strategist at Wells Fargo Asset Management, more than $600 billion in assets under management. He joins us on the phone from Milwaukee.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.